I'd be happy to humiliate myself. I'd be happy to bend over just to be somebody.
Okay, so I am here with Wayne Kirsten Baum. Is that correct?
That's pretty good. Okay. Kirsten, but there's no R.
Oh, there's no
Kirsten.
R.
Oh, Kirsten Baum.
Kirsten Baum. Oh, perfect. Kirsten Baum. Okay.
Yeah, there you got it.
There, I got it.
It
anyway,
clicked. Okay.
So now that we've got the pronunciation of his name, we should also note that he is most recently the author of Humiliation. Wayne, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm not humiliated.
Oh, okay. And I'm not humiliated by slandering your name in the first part.
No.
Because
no,
we corrected
you,
see?
I was putting you through perhaps a ritual that resembled punishment, and I didn't mean it.
Oh, no,
I promise
no.
Okay.
There's no one's been humiliated yet.
Okay, okay.
Although we do have possibly the three components of humiliation, which I want to talk about. You point out that humiliation is a triangle consisting of victim, abuser, and witness.
Yes.
And perhaps we have witnesses listening to this. But I wanted to ask, with the internet forms of humiliation that you identify, Googling arrival to discovering unflattering tidbits, listening to Alec Baldwin's voicemail, watching a Liza Minnelli video, or a student of yours, who is also a model, who, let's face the facts, you did your business with, the incident, in some sense, has already happened. And it may no longer be humiliating for the victim or the abuser, the party that you are witnessing. So if the victim or the abuser has moved on, how is humiliation on media, recorded humiliation, is this the same thing as experiential humiliation? Just to start here.
No, that's a really good point. I think I say in the book, referring to the photos of Susan Sontag's corpse, that her son, David Reif, referred to these as humiliating, and I suggest that since she's dead and can't feel the humiliation, who is being humiliated there? And I think I describe it as that there's an atmosphere of inference or identification in those survivors who look at the photos, but that it's difficult to locate the humiliation in any one body. And similarly with these sort of virtual humiliations, or as an example I've used before, is that if I receive a bad review and I don't read it or even hear about it, I am, I suppose, being humiliated in the eyes of people who read it, but if I'm not experiencing the humiliation, in what sense is it truly humiliating? Let's just say it's a spectacle of martyrdom perceived by others, but where the martyr is a cipher or a void.
Yeah. It seems to me that we're talking almost about statute of limitations on humiliation, pre-existing humiliation, which is what I seem to think. I'm wondering if the witness provides additional humiliation to, I suppose, either augment the pre-existing humiliation or possibly add an entirely new layer to it. I mean, is it humiliation if one of the three parties doesn't know that they're being humiliated?
As you were speaking, I thought, I want to reach a point in life where I can be present, where I can be humiliated and not experience it in that moment. You used the phrase, nice phrase, statute of limitations.
Yeah.
If I could have an instantaneous statute of limitations, or rather whether I could have a kind of edict of instantaneous revocation, or I could just sort of neutralize any damage that comes toward me. This is, unless I become the Dalai Lama, it's too late for that, is impossible. But to answer your question more directly, if there is no one, I mean, I don't know. I guess I don't need to be the king of defining humiliation in any way. And I understand that my nifty little paradigm of the triangle is
Illuminati-like, yeah.
Yeah, it occurs to me that some of the resonant instances of humiliation that I talk about obey this triangle. And let's face it, I like to find triangles everywhere I go. In this new book I have coming out in February about Harpo Marx, I talk about the numinousness of the number three. And the numbers, I say numbers are philosophical concepts to me. So I like the number three. So I get, there's a surplus pleasure for me in abstracting humiliation and labeling it a triangle. That's my pleasure.
But how abstract does humiliation have to be in order for us to identify it? That's really the interesting takeaway I get from your book. I get the concrete anecdotes of humiliation you have in the last fugue in the book, where it's something in the area of Stephanie that you name from your life. But, you know, a lot of people, they move on.
Yeah.
They don't cling to it as you perhaps do, or maybe you aren't clinging to this, and these are just sort of an itemization of various humiliations you've suffered, and you really want to pinpoint, maybe what is perhaps most helpful is to ask you, well, are you still humiliated by the moments that you document in the book?
Well, first, to answer something you said earlier in that little package,
sure.
is that I don't consider myself somebody who clings to past humiliations,
okay.
because, I would say that it's my business as writer to excavate,
sure.
and that the kind of excavation I do is often self-excavation, so that I would like myself to be characterized or seen as not somebody endlessly nursing old wounds or fingering old scars, but somebody who experimentally and for the sake of literature or for the sake of the pleasure of sentence making and the pleasure ideally of sentence receiving, in honor of those acts, I set about systematically excavating my memories. And I'm not saying it's a mechanical process, but it is a conscious aesthetic choice that has within it a certain degree of calculation and abstraction.
Yeah.
So, and at least the way I read that last chapter, that there is a tone of irony and disenchantment and non-woundedness that I hope hovers over the list. I don't consider it a lachrymose list, and I don't list probably the most humiliating things. And some of the things I list are merely amusing social embarrassments.
So, wait a minute. Yeah, there was a situation where you had to winnow it down. Maybe you had your top 100 humiliations. What can I actually divulge to the public? What can the public accept? And what ends up being the ones that I actually offer in my sort of way of saying that, hey, I too have practiced humiliation in my life, both as practitioner and victim.
Well, I mean, what happens when I write, and it's maybe when anyone writes, is I'm alone in a room. I seem to myself eons away from the hope of publication. I'm in a state of void and darkness, self-doubt, and pleasurelessness. And I try to rouse myself from stupor by exciting myself with memories or fantasies, or by attending to random thoughts and stimulations that occur within me. So I'm basically lying in an almost corpse-like state inwardly, cruising for glimmerings of wakefulness. Like basically, so that what I think about, so when I write down one of these so-called humiliating things, I feel like I'm sitting by the bedside of somebody with a failing heart and just listening for the occasional beat. I'm in a state of rapt attentiveness to my inner process, so that I'm not really even thinking about what effect it will have on others or what the repercussions might be on me. I'm actually listening. I'm listening to myself think and feel, and I tend to want to include the details that excite me the most and that terrify me the most.
Glimmerings that both regurgitate, as you say, extrude, as well as, I suppose, abreact.
Yes.
Okay.
We pray. We pray that they abreact. And some of them, I mean, I also, even though I said I don't cling, that's kind of a lie. I'm a very haunted person, I think, to some degree, and that's why I became a writer, and that certain scenes, certain kinds of relationships or emotional configurations, I'm obsessively drawn to as a writer and as a sentient human being. And humiliation is one of them. I mean, like I talk about the incident with the kid whose pants were pulled down in third grade and paddled. I've written about this scene in poems, in an essay. I've thought about it persistently, not with an enormous sense of woundedness, but with a kind of obsessed fascination and a respect for it as one of the origins of my creativity. If I didn't have that scene, why would I even have bothered being a writer? And so I approach it with a little bit of awe and certainly curiosity, but reverence for its truth and a sense of deep numinousness and mystery when I approach it. I would even say it's kind of sacred to me, scenes like that. So I'm not clinging to them, but I am... they galvanize me. They are the source of my writing.
So specific empirical anecdotes along these lines, it seems to me that what you're almost confessing to a large degree is that they can be, I suppose, shifted around to serve the needs of the conceptual thesis. In this case, humiliation.
Absolutely.
In another case, okay. So the malleability of your experience is what you're drawing from. To some degree, it almost seems like this might cheapen your experience, or how does this work for you?
It doesn't. I tend to write about the distant past rather than the near past, and the distant past is immune to be, cheapened. My experience never cost very much to begin with, so I don't know if there's some high point from which my experience can plummet. Let me think about this for a second.
Well, you have to have some high point if you're talking about humiliation, right?
I have a lot of primal scenes. For me, my life is a sequence of first times. And that when I write, I look for those primal scenes. In my book on opera, The Queen's Throat, I talk about the first time I heard an opera or the first time I heard Anna Moffo's voice. In an essay recently, I talked about the first time I heard Brahms' D minor piano concerto. In this book, I talk about, the first time I saw somebody punished, or the first, it's not necessarily always the first time, but there, I do, certain scenes for me have cathexis, as Freud's translators put it. In terms of cheapening, no, I think that there's a transition from aura to non-aura. These experiences for me have aura, so I write about them. When they don't have aura, they're over, and I'll be writing about new scenes, but there's no interim period of cheapening.
Yeah, or there is a statute of limitations, perhaps, in which they become experiences that are no longer, I suppose, bothering you, and they're fair game to be explored further upon the page.
I'm curious still about this word cheapening. I've been using these days, sometimes in interviews, the word coarsening, and I'm very suspicious of myself when I say coarsening. I talk about a coarsening of moral sympathies these days.
Say vitiating,
I suppose. Yeah, no. And so I'm wondering what the notion of cheapening, what... I imagine that what you're suggesting is that to expose oneself in public is to cheapen one's dignity or to lower... I don't know. What do you mean by cheapening?
Okay, maybe I should...
You could just revoke the word.
No. I mean, what I mean to say is that when you live a life and you are a writer and you are writing about your experience, it seems to me that if you're... that there's a maximum amount of experience that you actually want to mine from. At least that's my own belief. There's a friend of mine, perfectly interesting writer, but she has the tendency to write about everything in a way that I don't necessarily believe to have the depth or the wisdom or the insight to learn from it or to transfer any kind of learning onto an audience. To enlighten, even in the cheapest of possible ways, a different kind of cheap. So as such, the experience that one is supposed to learn from sort of becomes cheapened, and regrettably, with the word cheapen, as we've talked about, it seems to me, based off of your last explanation, I don't think you do cheapen in what I'm talking about. But I was just curious
I understand what you mean now, Mort. Yeah. I would say there are experiences that I don't write about, and it's not for fear of cheapening them, but I mean, for example, I really don't write about my boyfriend.
Yeah.
The guy I've lived with for many years. I call him my boyfriend, Steve. I have written about him somewhat, but I don't write about him. I could, but it doesn't, that I don't consider that to be my material. I don't write about my brothers and sisters very much at all. They appear as bit players in this book, but I don't really talk about them. I talk a lot in my work about my parents.
You also offer the disclaimer for your family members in this, that you're not certain if you are humiliating them by bringing up these experiences, even though they're very well in the past, and it sounds to me, I'm sure you probably asked them, hey, can I write about this?
Yeah. Well, so, and I also... my mother, who's a wonderful poet herself, from the time I was in high school when she refound her voice, wrote has been writing very intimate autobiographical poetry, including about my father, her divorce from him, her sex life, you know, the whole, so that I grew up in a family where disclosure was normal. To some extent, I don't, I'm not, it's
so,
not
so
like an
abnormal for you to hold back and write it.
It's not an uptight WASP family. Yeah. We don't have good manners in my family.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wanted to, I mean, this seems a good segue. I wanted to talk about the large woman you observed on 6th Avenue in the 1980s. She urinates in the middle of the sidewalk. You point out that she was shameless and unbothered, yet you could sense her actions' ripple effect on every witness. You bring up the lovely Edith Massey, who was a fixture in John Waters' movies. You identify two types of viewers, the kind who believes that Waters was humiliating Massey, and the kind who sees Massey's abjectness as radiant. You use the term transvalued antipodes. So it seems to me that, going back to what I was suggesting at the outset, humiliation is a subjective experience. A victim has to feel victimized. An abuser needs to feel that she has abused. A witness has to see the incident. So if one of the three parties is not playing the game, I think feeling neither humiliation or even schadenfreude isn't really humiliation.
Right.
I mean,
it's
interesting.
So, like, to take the Edith Massey example,
yes.
Can we? Is that
absolutely
fair?
I'd love to talk about Edith Massey.
Yeah, okay. And I saw Female Trouble the other night too, so I had a chance again to confront her magnificence and the kind of morally problematic, or just the brilliantly multivalent aspect of her performance. And I thought, so okay, the first scene, very first scene in Female Trouble in which Edith Massey appears, she's topless.
Yeah.
She's probably about 60 something. And she's fondling her breasts.
Yeah.
And it's a really shocking scene. It's not, she has like very few teeth left in her mouth. She's not, it's not what we expect from cinematic spectacle. It's neither like a girly flick, like a Russ Meyer film. It's like a parody of a Russ Meyer film, but with a really strange casting choice. It's really unclear what the transaction is there. There's John, you could say John Waters is the creator or the instigator of the spectacle.
Yeah.
You could say that Edith Massey is either his victim, I would never say that, or his collaborator, or is part of a complicated transaction with John Waters, a very complicated transaction that the entire film tries to solve the mystery of. What does it mean to be at once atrocious and radiant?
Yeah.
You know, as divine when her acid is thrown on her face and she still thinks she's like the most famous woman in the world. What do we make of that absolute lack of reality testing? In a sense, I don't know, but I don't. All I can say as a witness, I'm the witness, say, of Female Trouble, the movie. I respond with a sense of rapture, laughter, and joy at Edith Massey's boldness, shamelessness, even her weird Rubenesque beauty.
To me, it's her voice that humanizes her. It's that. You know, that's sort of like, it's kind of childlike, it's definitely having some kind of fun. And Divine, oddly enough, is the same situation, where it's the voice that makes us humanize that particular person who is grotesque visually. But I would say that it's not necessarily John Waters throwing out a spectacle, but also laying down the gauntlet, saying, here, can you go beyond this particular point? Like much challenging.
Why I think another reason he's so brilliant, he's asking us, he's saying, okay, when you look at Jane Mansfield, when you look at Elizabeth Taylor or Tuesday Weld or whatever the cinematic precursors of an Edith Massey, you are also looking at, in your unconscious, Edith Massey. And when you are looking literally at Elizabeth Taylor, because Divine is sort of Elizabeth Taylor's bad echo, when you are looking at the good star, you are also looking at the bad star. So he is, John Waters force-fed America the kind of fecal doppelgangers of its sexual idols as an act of education, I think.
Yeah.
I think it was an act of house cleaning and space claiming for those who didn't qualify for stardom, and just asserting that they too have something starry in them, and that also the things that we supposedly revere are also sordid, secretly sordid.
But to tie this back into humiliation, does it even matter if Edith Massey is aware that she is being humiliated in some sense, or that one member of the audience, an unseen audience at that, is possibly, you know, the first type that you had mentioned, is staring down at her? I mean, that's what causes humiliation for me to be, I don't know, from my standpoint, it seems that you need to have all three parties complicit in the humiliation in order for it to count, because if the whole purpose is to lower someone's status, and if Edith Massey doesn't give a shit about,
or doesn't have any status in a conventional way, she's being upgraded. I also think with Edith, the feeling I have watching Edith Massey is one essentially of love, not mockery. She's lovable. She's honest. She's not really posing. She seems cooperative. She sang the lines that John Waters gave her. She's, you said humanized, which is true. She seems beautifully ordinary, down to earth, and also recognizable. I mean, you described her as grotesque, and we're kind of taking for granted that there's something not conventionally attractive about her. That is true. But the older I get and the more kinds of bodies in the world I see, the more willing I am to just accept that Edith Massey looks pretty good.
Yeah.
When she's wearing her seductive suit, you know, or her, I don't know how to even describe her kind of stripper outfit with all the cleavage and the bits of flesh from the side. Let's just say she looks good, and let's imagine a world in which we can say that Edith Massey looks good and has a right to display her body if she wants to.
Sure.
And she clearly wants to.
To get on this subject from a different vantage point, I wanted to bring up David Foster Wallace's essay, Big Red Sun. This is an essay about the adult film industry.
I haven't read it, but you can say whatever you want about
it. No problem, okay. Because there is one particular observation in this that matches something that's in your book. He has a story about an LAPD detective who is a big fan of hardcore porn. The detective confesses that the chief appeal of porn to him is the moment where an actress's face shifted from what Wallace describes as a stylized fuck me, I'm a nasty girl sneer to that rare moment with which, well, the actress is now having a legitimate moment of tenderness, a genuine tenderness, or an orgasm. And that moment, that facade, that pretense strips away. Now, in your book, you describe watching a YouTube video of Anita Bryant. She's getting pied in the face at a 1977 news conference in Des Moines. You write that at the moment Bryant is pied in the face, suddenly she is no longer a wretched anti-gay activist. Suddenly she is a victim, a woman physically being assaulted by a male stranger. So the fact that you've watched this video repeatedly also suggests an almost pornographic draw to humiliation. It could be argued that for most people who see a video like that, seeing it once, seeing her pied in the face, ha-ha, but then you move on, perhaps think about it. But in your case, it's very comparable to the LAPD detective. So I was curious, from all standpoints, to what degree is humiliation an effort to see the alien, the malevolent, as human?
I like that. I mean, I love that your last formulation. They're seeing the malevolent as human. So that it's a kind of reparative exercise. That, you know, again and again, I need to renovate Anita Bryant and make her good. But, I mean, a much simpler answer in this case, and it might be not merely reductive, but interesting, is to say that because I was writing a book, I had to watch it many times.
And that's true.
Honestly, I probably wouldn't see it many times. There's some things I would see many times, like the Liza clips. I would watch those repeatedly. The Anita Bryant... it was shocking to me that I actually felt such kind of horror and empathy, horror at my own complicity with the aggressors, because they're the gay activists, I'm on their side, I'm totally with them, but the second that they throw the pie in her face and I see the genuine shock, non-feigned, non-programmatic shock on her face, and then she cries, it's real. And it is like the pornographic moment. I'm with that. The guy who describes porn, his favorite moment is when it becomes real. I think later in the book, I also describe that moment for me is when the model, the porn star, whatever, looks directly in my eyes.
Yeah.
And there's something actual in that encounter, as if I'm stealing or kidnapping him away from his fictive world of porn and staging a real encounter with him.
Yeah.
That is very exciting and very phenomenologically rich and scary.
But shouldn't being human or understanding the many angles of being human involve sympathizing with both sides, both Anita Bryant and the person who wants to pie her in the face? Because from my standpoint, you know, I have not actually seen the video, and perhaps I should. I should have done that before I even talked with you. But it seems to me that it's our human duty to try to understand both sides. Wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I absolutely would. And I tend to split. It's a sort of psychoanalytic word, I think, for a process of compartmentalization and polarizing. And I think eventually I travel between both poles and I sympathize with both points of view, but I tend to sequence it so that I'm, for example, in the Anita Bryant story, I spend, let's say, a half an hour being the gay activist, and then I spend 5 minutes being Anita Bryant. But there's a certain artificially polarized theater of affect for me, rather than a kind of simultaneous acknowledgement. Yeah, they're both, you know, like I heard somebody say the other day, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans can cooperate on this damn budget thing, and they don't. And I thought within, don't lump the Democrats in with the Republican. The Republicans have nothing in common. I refuse that kind of evening out middle of the road logic. That's a different example, but it reminded me of my tendency to embrace extremes.
Yeah. You either need to be an optimist for a situation, or this is one thing I could think of, which is that humiliation, any moment along those lines, causes us to choose a side. We have to either be with the victim or be with the abuser. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I think in the scenes of childhood punishment that I talk about, or the paradigm really of childhood punishment, it is a polarized scene. I mean, it is, and I'm thinking of Freud's essay, A Child Is Being Beaten, where the child reimagines being beaten as a scene of being loved. There is something fathomless about the scene of childhood punishment. And perhaps, indeed, there are two points of view in many scenes of childhood punishment. What is remembered maybe as a scene of punishment is actually one of education. But there remains a kind of Manichaean separation between the tyrant and the victim.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. In Catheter, you write at the end, I have a noble aim, to urge you to be kind when you see someone humiliated, even if you think the shamed person deserves punishment. When you find someone like Alec Baldwin sexually attractive, and in your own words, wondering why I agree to occupy this role rather than to refuse it by vowing to ignore the tabloid trade of trashing the stars, I'm wondering, are you being kind to Alec Baldwin? If you don't know the figure who is being humiliated, if you've never met them, can you always be kind? I'm curious about this.
You mean because is that like the tree falling in the forest thing? Like if I'm kind to Alec Baldwin by not reading a scandalous story about him, how will he know I'm being kind?
Yeah.
Or
that, and also this compelling allure of participating in the culture. I mean, when that whole thing came out, I heard about it from friends, and it's like, oh, well, this is whatever. It's this typical tabloid culture. But I made a conscious choice not to participate in it because I just felt it wasn't worth my time. I'm only getting one side of the story. I don't know Alec Baldwin. I like him as an actor, but, you know, what business is it of mine? You know what I mean? So as a result, it seems to me that you're finding, or you're sort of vacillating between should I participate to be or not to be.
Right. Well, let's say, I totally get your point, that you're talking about a kind of conscientious objection to, or an abstaining from the gladiatorial carnival of consuming celebrity carrion.
Absolutely.
And I understand that. I would say that in my life, I have made a few golden exceptions to that rule because of deep libidinal and imaginative connections that I have.
Yeah.
And so, for example, like having written a whole book about Jackie Onassis, that's a case where I flagrantly did not abstain from the national profession of consuming images of Jackie. I indulged it, but that's because I had deep unconscious motives, and I felt that it was much for me was personally at stake in pursuing that obsession. If in the case that you're mentioning, where you like Alec Baldwin as an actor, but you don't have strong feelings about him, it's not a difficult thing for you to abstain. For me, like Alec Baldwin, I didn't consume it as deeply originally as I did when I decided to write about it, but I do have a kind of long-standing crush on Alec Baldwin. I've interviewed him. I wrote about him in my book Cleavage, a little My Evening with Alec Baldwin. We're the same age.
Yeah.
He is a kind of weird, hectoring ego ideal. Hectoring isn't the right word. He seems like a kind of bossy guy. Or something. He's a kind of macho ego ideal for me, and I have cast him in my drama, but I'm using him as a teaching point.
But how could you be kind? I mean, I think you nailed it on the head there by pointing out and being fully candid about the fact that you do have there's an allure there, there's a sexual attraction there, that he forms some imaginary impulse for all sorts of things in your mind, which is perfectly fine, and that's completely understandable. But at the same time, can you also be kind when you have that going on as well? I mean, it's almost as if this is another instigation point for humiliation as well.
Yeah. Right. No. I will say then, okay, that toward Alec Baldwin, perhaps I have not been supremely kind, but I'm not alone in, and I would like to think, maybe I'm dreaming, I would like to think that I'm placing the whole Alec Baldwin crease within a really large cultural context of these kinds of spectacles. And I'm revealing, I'm saying, on the one hand, I get a sort of sadistic, erotic relish from this. And on the other hand, I wish to abstain from the process of scapegoating others. I am never saying he's a bad father. There's never a moment where I pass judgment on him. I'm commenting instead on on his use of the word humiliating in the thing to his daughter. It's hard for me to really explain this except to say that I'm not making judgments about Alec Baldwin. I'm making judgments about the star culture and the culture of scapegoating.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It can be argued that the London riots, which occurred a few days ago at the time of this conversation, that they arose because you have the poor, the young, the disenfranchised, given no choice. Essentially, they are humiliated. Thus, you have revolt from humiliation. You touch upon this very early in the book, where you deal with revolt, activism, and uprising as a response to humiliation. You conclude that choosing homicidal martyrdom as a response to historical humiliation, I become a suicide bomber. What of this space in between which causes riots, and very often you have no progress but more of the same? How do you reconcile what we've been talking about here is essentially privileged humiliation versus an unprivileged humiliation in which it's unrest or activism and that kind of thing?
I mean, I don't have profound or definitive things to say about that. That's a moral conundrum for deeper minds than mine, honestly. But the question of, in a way, it's the question of justified violence or of revolution, that a violent revolution, and when it's justified and when it's not, and who's to decide when it's justified. That's a big question, and I think I want to say case by case. I would hesitate to make any generalizations about revolution.
Yeah.
And I think I talk about what I call the Rosa Parks principle, where humiliation leads to uprising and activism, or France Fanon in the Wretched of the Earth is, but let's just call it the suicide bomber or the terrorist question. I don't want to like say pro terrorist things because I don't really feel very pro terrorist.
Yeah. But are willing to confront what you call the Jim Crow gays.
Yeah.
That look where someone looks at another person as if there is nothing there, complete invisibility, entirely because of race and also often because of class or because of sexual orientation, what have you. It seems to me that willingness on your part to tackle this difficult question doesn't necessarily make your views on humiliation legitimate or doesn't make them transferable from this place of privilege and this place of media obsession to this really stark territory of how do I get by when I don't have any options in the streets.
Right, right.
Okay, no thoughts in terms of the Jim Crow gays in comparison to, say, the Alec Baldwin stuff we were talking about before?
Yeah, no, it's just total... I talk about both things in the book because it seems that with a title and a subject like humiliation... I mean, for one thing, I don't want to write a book just about, like, the Alec Baldwin things.
Sure.
That's only one question that interests me, and I was just as much motivated to write this book by the Abu Ghraib things.
Yeah.
But as I say, very honestly, I said there were three catalysts. There was Clinton, Michael Jackson, and Abu Ghraib. They have very little to do with each other, but there is a kind of sliding, there is a kind of spectrum where there's all three instances involve the United States, power, scandal, and sex, or the sexualizing of, I don't know, I don't want to say glib or wrong things.
Yeah.
So I try in this book to, through the use of these fragments, the numbered fragments, to keep as separate as possible some of these kinds of instances for exactly, I think, what you're suggesting, that it's not possible to map what you're calling privileged humiliations, or as I describe in my own, you know, having had a relatively humiliation-free and lucky life, nonetheless, I have, you know, I could go into this litany of my humiliations.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to say that all suffering is the same.
Yes. Life is not a comparison of horrors and that kind of thing.
No.
Well, let me try to get on this from another angle. You had mentioned very early on, and I was actually going to bring this up too, the photos that Annie Leibovitz took of Susan Sontag. The Osama bin Laden execution. There was no photo of a dead body. Saddam Hussein's execution, we do get to see him. Now, you write of Leibovitz taking these photos of Sontag's corpse, as we said earlier, quoting David Reif, who said that he was humiliated posthumously. Now, if one...
No, he said that she was humiliated.
She was humiliated posthumously.
Yeah.
My mistake. So the question is, if one doesn't have the choice of seeing the photos or the woman you observe at the grocery store, which you write about afterward, is it still possible to humiliate the object or the person? Was the decision, for example, to not release the Osama photos a more respectful choice, or was it possibly something that really, to use the word cheapen again, by not giving American the options to humiliate or to not humiliate, maybe it was almost a dishonest choice. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to, like, chicken out of a question, but
yeah.
I don't know. Do I really want to talk about the Osama bin Laden photos? I don't know. It feels like that feels way beyond what I can speak about responsibly, in a way. I mean, I maybe...
Even if you were also simultaneously asking us to feel kindness for those who are absolutely terrible as well.
Yeah, no. I mean, the only reason I say I don't want it just seems, just because I wrote this book doesn't mean I feel like I'm the expert on the world's atrocities or I'm some extraordinary moral barometer in a way. So that's a big, the question has a lot of responsibility tied into it, as if, because I mentioned the Susan Sontag photos in the book, I'm automatically going to have an opinion about the Osama bin Laden photos, which I don't. I mean, basically, I don't have a stand about yes, release all photos, or no, don't release all photos. Maybe I don't understand your question.
Maybe the direct question to ask you, yeah, is Osama worthy of the same respect if someone is being humiliated as David Reif suggested of Sontag?
Well, is that then the question of like, is it possible to imagine that Hitler had a mother and yeah, that she loved him? I mean, is there... And that's, again, a question way too complicated to know the answer to. Like, is it possible to include in the human family some of the worst people? And I do say in the book that, when I imagine or see, a serial killer led to his execution whimpering, I feel clemency rise within me. Yeah, I have that impulse. I bet you do too, if you're asking the question. Yeah. Yeah, I do have that impulse.
Yeah. Okay. At two points in the book, you bring up the interesting idea of humiliation being applied to words and language. Early in the book, you write that Shakespeare humiliates the prior body of language, the poor body of English, lackluster before he came along and renovated it. Later on, in relation to Basquiat's paintings and his many crossed out words, you write, "To cross out a word is to humiliate it. To cross out a word is to indicate, however obliquely, that words have already crossed me out." Now, I had to say, I'm wondering if this is a bit hyperbolic. You do offer an explanation, but I just wanted to offer my own personal anecdote. I started only a few days ago reading Finnegan's Wake for the first time. Now, in terms of the potential humiliation factor of not being able to know the references or all the double meanings or all of the portmanteaus, you could be humiliated, but I don't feel humiliated by that. I feel, wow, here's all this cool shit in front of me. There's nothing to be humiliated because I'm starting at the very bottom. I'm here to learn. And I suspect that that's the case with Shakespeare and Basquiat's paintings. Your modest rebuttal later in Shock Treatment Aesthetics is that you feel humiliation as an internal event and that you must talk about words as objects. But, you and I are talking right now. If we were to transcribe this conversation, we're probably, 10,000 words or something like that. If we lay claim to them, then we get into the subject of ego rather than this kind of organic flow of what it is to be alive. So I'm curious, why apply this humiliation like this to words and language when... one doesn't have to feel humiliated. One can feel all sorts of possibilities in the air,
No, one can. Yeah. Indeed, one can feel anything one wants to. The fact is, though, when I read Shakespeare, yeah, and particularly when I read King Lear,
yeah,
my inner ear hears that Shakespeare's virtuosity has a kind of... radical muscularity and almost violence to it. Its genius is so intense and its diction is so sharp and new and the metaphor is so breathtaking and it's just so creaming and full that I can feel the stirring within me of aggression. Aggression in the service of aesthetics. And so I then, my thinking or theorizing mind says, wait, why is the beauty and opulence of Shakespeare's language producing in me this feeling of surge? What's being hit? And I'm thinking, well, it's just iambic pentameter. It's just this. It's just an abstract thud of the beat. But then I'm saying, no, it's not. What's being hit is Shakespeare's, a genius line of Shakespeare is sort of mauling the weird, stunted, absent twin of the non-Shakespeare line. It's hard to explain, but I can feel it. And when he says, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet bird sang, there is pressure in that line. Bare ruined choirs where late the sweet bird sang. There is a kind of, I won't call it aggression, but that there is a thrust or a push in those lines that... To me, the question is worth asking, where is the is there violence of a exciting kind in that line? If so, who are the parties to the violence? And I start to think, and this is maybe just kind of Harold Bloom-like, yeah, writing is aggressive. Writing is patricidal, regicidal, matricidal. Thinking, as Chris Davis says, is matricidal. Or she, Melanie Klein says it, and Chris Davis quotes her, that there we need to be willing to think, however abstractly, that there are kinds of psychic aggression and violence and matricide, regicide, infanticide, what have you, logocide going on in the poem. And so in terms of Basquiat, or I can imagine, okay, he's taking that oil stick and he is crossing out the word. He does that with physical pleasure, and he does it, and I know what it's like to write with physical pleasure, and I feel when I inscribe muscularly with, you know, when I'm writing, I am making a mark, and the mark making is exciting a little bit because it's violent.
Yeah.
And I know that, well, then I say, well, what's being mauled? And I'm saying my silence is being destroyed, or the people I'm talking about are being destroyed, or my own former inferiority is being destroyed. But I'm willing, and maybe just kind of flamboyantly and, as you say, hyperbolically psychoanalytic register, to imagine fantasy scenarios that are hovering around quite calm aesthetic scenes.
But when you write any word down, and maybe it's the first thought on your mind, it seems the right word, you cross it out and you put a better word on top of that, I mean, is that really humiliation, or is that just the sorting of several thoughts? I mean, well, it's not like you can't return back to that word
but
later.
Let's just say in the case of Basquiat, Basquiat is performing there in his paintings. You know, he's listing, he's talking about the slave trade. He's the copyright logo. He's consciously, and I think very explicitly, critiquing the sign system of American power and his own place or non-place in it. And he's, by writing on a painting, you're not supposed to write on painting. You're not supposed to, the cross out in his case there means mistake. And that by making the mistake, the artwork, he is provocatively putting forward his wrongness as the new gold standard. I don't know. It's different. I think Finnegan's Wake, I mean, I'm no Joycean, but I think that what Joyce does to language participates absolutely in this fecal and amniotic and regicidal carnival that I'm talking about with Shakespeare and Basquiat.
Oh, yeah.
He is entering the mother tongue and pleasuring it and mauling it. And Gertrude Stein does the same. These are extreme artists who I think are doing major kinds of creative damage to their instrument.
But how does this internal feeling transform into a sense of humiliation? This is what fascinates me and what I'm trying to get at. You know, when I experience a collision in words, or in Joyce in particular, the sandwiching of words together, where you know, where multitude and malt becomes multitude, for example. I'm not even on page 10, for God's sakes, but it's great. For me, it gives me just a great feeling of vigor and what it is to be alive. The violence actually excites me, just as seeing a particularly well-done violent movie. Oh, I don't feel any sense of humiliation by it. Like, I see a John Woo movie, it's like, hey, that's fucking cool, right?
But yeah, I'm an amalgamator, right? I mean, I know what you're saying, right? I could have, but it's like what you said about my childhood scenes, that they're malleable. Yeah, of course, I could write about this kind of the joyous, aggressive juxtaposition in Joyce or Shakespeare, that cramming together of words with an entirely different vocabulary. I don't have to describe it as humiliation, but because the project that I set out to write was humiliation, these examples emerged within my thinking, and I found an exciting applicability to them. I like wrenching a paradigm. I like violent and forced juxtapositions. And yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I could talk about Shakespeare's virtuosity in a million other ways, but the fact is I was writing a book called Humiliation, and I was canvassing my inner life and my aesthetic life for examples where I felt that major human dynamics were at stake, including the dynamic of discipline and punish, or smack the language till it is born or can't breathe.
Sure. I had one last question that may sort of reconcile what you're talking about here. One of the stories you offer at the end of the book is this acquaintance of yours who says, "I'm the reason Random House rejected your book." You report that he smiled and that you pretended to consider his confessions witty and piquant. But there were many other options. In my mind, when I was reading this, I was thinking, God, this guy's a complete fucking asshole. There are many other options here. You could have punched him in the face in punishment for his lack of respect for you. You could have responded with a scathing witticism that restored the situation to what it was before and therefore cleared the slate, so to speak. You could have walked away and just not dealt with this guy, because if he's not going to respect you, what's the purpose of dealing with him? I don't know the exact circumstances, but to my mind, yes, that is a level of humiliation, but it does recall the Eleanor Roosevelt maxim that nobody can make you feel inferior without your consent. So I have to ask, it would seem to me that letting this guy humiliate you through your consent, what of this? Does this kind of reset the bar of what humiliation is? I mean, why talk about humiliation without talking about this notion of consent? Because I think that's really, that's really the crux of this.
It's an interesting point. You're right, of course. Not every insult. Well, I'm reminded of Freud, in the interpretation of dreams, talks about a pivotal moment in his childhood where an anti-Semite on the streets of Vienna, I think Vienna, knocked off his father's hat. And Freud remembers being very disappointed and ashamed that his father didn't confront the anti-Semite, but just like picked up his hat and went on, and that this was a kind of a crucial fall from grace for Freud vis-a-vis his father as a powerful figure. So I'm thinking of, yes, the cases where one can or cannot rebut the accuser. And you're right, in the incident, but I don't give context for any of these things. They're like little haiku of humiliation, and I don't say much, and I don't need to say too much more now, but that just to say, yeah, you're right. There are many instances of social cruelty or sadism where we have a wide variety of responses if we can think quickly, and if we are not already steeped in humiliation, we need to have our wits about us. And maybe one didactic purpose of the book is to encourage people to guard against humiliation, to have more options, to stop consenting, certainly to stop humiliating other people, to call a moratorium on things like that guy said to me.
Or to basically move along in one's life without these kinds of people. I mean, my feeling in life is that if someone's going to go ahead and sit there and insult you, and it's not just a bunch of friendly joshing, then, all right, you've proven to me that you don't respect me, and so I can't necessarily respect you. So I don't need that in my life.
But I think also saying pretty consciously or not so subtly is that here I am, here's this nice little book that you've, I hope, bought, and you're reading it, and you're near the end of it, and it's a pretty little package, and it's published by a beautiful publisher, but it will include a story of a book that was refused by another publisher that like sewn right into the heart of this book is a deep consciousness of writerly failure and the kind of... Yeah, writing is not a victory game, and it isn't that a book that triumphantly... this book is not triumphantly marching toward its conclusion.
Yeah.
And that I'm making a statement about how pocked writing, the writing life is, or even the act of speaking is, with a consciousness of its failure, its fallibility, its liability to be insulted and accused.
But what of vengeance?
What of what?
Vengeance.
Vengeance. I'm not... Yeah, that's... that. We're back to the suicide bombers and Osama and all that. Yeah.
But a lot of people get revenge by either living well or doing well.
I did publish the book.
You did publish the book.
I did get my vengeance.
There's the T.C. Boyle thing where he basically says... bury your enemies and bury them deep. That's how he got revenge against his enemies, by just constantly publishing. I mean, you can go on if you, I mean, I don't know, not necessarily in a vengeful way, but in the way that that in which you know you're living a dignified life.
I mean, I don't, as a writer, I don't really, I mean, maybe I am getting vengeance. I'm publishing 2 more books next year. So I'm actually I'm in a period of great ripeness and productivity at the moment. So I don't think of it as vengeance, except I suppose in the sense that Shakespeare was mauling the English language. Yeah, there is aggression in writing. But I don't...
Yeah. But don't you give strength to that humiliation by memorializing it and publishing it in this book?
No, I think I turn it... I aim to turn it into a set of amusing petty fours. That last chapter, at least, I think of as a kind of rosary beads or... I don't know. That last chapter does... I don't think I'm memorializing it. I don't. Maybe you do. Clearly you do. I don't. Uh-uh. No way. I think it's...
I like the book.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, but no, I think it's... Those are the kind of sentences I'm drawn to write.
Okay, well, that seems a very good way to out. But Wayne, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting.
Okay.
All right.